Hey, good people. It's your girl, Frederica McClary Easley, and I am back with another episode of The People Are Blunt. Y'all know what it is. Y'all see it. We have an amazing guest with us today that may be a little surprising to some, but I think as we get into the conversation, the topic, all of the dots will be connected. But before we get into that, and before I allow her to introduce herself, again, for the merch plug, The People's Ecosystem. Y'all see my shirt. It's awesome. I also have some additional tchotchkes that may at some point become available in terms of The People Are Blunt. This actually keeps all of my beverages either hot or cold, and we need that nowadays. So without further ado, Ms. MJ Carpella, how are you?
Yes, hi. Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited. I'm well. And to your point, excited to get into how our two worlds collide, though many listeners are probably going to not really see that connection right away until we paint it. So excited.
Absolutely. And, you know, we all have a little bit of creative in us. So happy to get those paintbrushes out and start painting that picture today. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So my name is MJ Corpella, and I am a consultant, an early childhood and families consultant. So that just means that I support programs, nonprofits, schools, philanthropists in just kind of designing and supporting engagements that focus on improving circumstances for families and really, really small kids. So my team and I focuses on prenatal all the way through third grade brain development and programming circumstances. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was gonna say awesome. Just to kind of give a little context in terms of why I thought it was so important to have you on. So yes, you know, we're in the cannabis space, and we often talk about the war on drugs, right? And how individuals were impacted. And we mentioned how communities have also been impacted due to cannabis prohibition, due to the disparate treatment that communities of Black, Latinx, and Indigenous people have experienced, right? But I wanted you on today because I wanted to really dig into the community impact of the war on drugs and specifically cannabis prohibition. I think that there are tons of correlations and conversations that you and I have had off screen that really got us to this point. And so without further ado, let's jump into it.
Yeah, definitely. So to your point of kind of how we got to this point, a little bit more context for me. So I started out my career in mental health. So I'm trained as a therapist, actually. And when I started, I knew I wanted to support families and I wanted to help people. And I did a trauma focus, right? So brain development and the impact of traumatic experiences on families and kids was my focus coming up for school, grad school, first couple of jobs. It did not take long to realize that the work that we were doing as mental health providers was really fixing issues and concerns for families that never needed to be there, that should never have happened, that we should never have been in those circumstances to where me as a young clinician sitting in front of teenagers who have exponentially growing trauma, even though it's as I'm sitting there. And so I quickly made a shift into figuring out how to get there earlier and how to make sure that these things never happened. So I did programs for 7 or 8 years in early childhood and families. And that was cool for a minute too, right? It was really doing great work for the families that we were serving. We've really seen some great outcomes and being able to impact outcomes and circumstances for the kids that we had in these programs. But came in the last couple of years or so to realize that I can do 100 kids in any of my programs, and yet there are tens of thousands still in all of these communities who won't enter one of these programs and who won't have that type of support and benefit for their development. Which shifted me into looking at systems work and doing consulting and really trying to take what I've learned from just kind of being right there in it with families to try to influence that bigger picture systems piece, including what you and I have talked about, the impact of the war on drugs and just the reputation that has brought to our communities, looking at how that's impacting people right now. Yeah. A little bit of context.
So no, thank you. Thank you for that. Let's dig into these systems, right? Because, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And so, you know, with most of these impacted communities, as well as individuals, right? People are figuring out ways to operate outside of systems. people are figuring out ways within their communities and within their personal lives to create the structure and the infrastructure that they need, right? So when we have mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles, you know, taken from communities, right, and put in prison or made to be second-class citizens once they have, like, felonies on their record, there are so many resources that they are no longer able to take advantage of, right? So that's like housing, that is, you know, education, all of those things. And so this is something that, like, you and I had an aha moment in terms of, so we know, like, with cannabis, right, there are legacy operators, right? There are people who have been for, you know, 30, 40 years, maybe even more than that, though, operating and have, like, real businesses. I mean, like, these, they have business models that rival those, you know, who have gone to these Ivy League schools, right, and are CEOs and or founders of above board businesses, right, today, right? They have these infrastructures underground where, like, they have loyal customers. They, you know, they have, they figured out testing. They figured out all these things, right? The same thing exists in community.
The same thing exists in community. Yeah, this was to your point, this aha moment for me in just in learning from you and hearing what you're discussing. And in the same way that I've learned directly from you and the people ecosystem work, that there's all aspects of the plant, right? There's all different focus areas of this industry, and so many, like, really positive implications when you're looking at each side of the equation. So early childhood and families and community has the same consideration. So families for decades have found ways to care for each other and to come up with these really innovative solutions to the concerns that really have been created by the systems that they're a part of. To your point about families being, parents being taken, what happens when dad is taken out of the equation or when mom is taken out of the equation? Auntie steps up, or someone down the street steps up, or friends, or people care for each other's babies. What happens when we can't afford childcare, but we want to go to work? We care for each other's kids. What happens when we can't get a degree, so we can't technically get licensed childcare, if you will, and we're called, quote unquote, like, low quality, or we're not considered a high quality program? What happens then? We still do it. We still, when I say we, I'm talking about communities, right? We still care for each other's kids. We have somebody who is still providing really caring, loving conditions for the babies that are around them. We have exchange of goods and services, typically as payment, right? Instead of, like, I'm mom, I don't have the cash to be giving you the money, but I can help you out with whatever it is you need. I can do some cleaning. I can get you ready to go. I can give you a break with your babies. Like, we have an exchange of goods and services and social capital and market.
An ecosystem, like, essentially communities, the ecosystem where there's bartering. It's like, I have this, you have that. And how are we exchanging those goods and services?
A full ecosystem. And even to the similar way that, like, cannabis has had this kind of, like, negative connotation for so long, despite not being a negative thing for us to have at all, early childhood really has a history of, like, not being considered important as well, not being really cared for. And it also has a similar history in terms of, like, who's been caring for our babies for the entire history of this country?
Yeah.
The answer is women of color. Black women specifically have been caring for all of our babies, our collective, our babies, for the entire history of this country. We've known for decades that the first year of life sets a trajectory for the rest of life without intervention. We know that education, emotional regulation, mental health service, all those things, all those things are important from day one within the first year. We've known that, but yet we still haven't really started to take that first year in the quote unquote, like, babysitting and nannying and childcare seriously until really recently. And now all of a sudden, now that we're all paying attention, all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of resources and a whole bunch of interest and a bunch of really kind of powerful people talking about early childhood and childcare. We see resources being put into those programs. But similar to the cannabis industry, we see resources going in, but we're not naturally seeing them going into what I call legacy providers as well. In our space, we're seeing new schools being built. We're seeing public funding being considered for pre-K. So important. We must get there, and we are going to get there. but we're seeing it coming through without consideration for the women who have been doing this work already. And I will say too, not only been doing it, but have documented research-based outcomes in the method that they're doing. Head Start has decades of positive impact, primarily done by women of color since the beginning of it. But it's not the main focus as we start to think about resources here.
So I want to dig into this, because this was something that, you know, so this is something that was amazing to me, or still amazing to me, because, you know, our stance is, in terms of cannabis, one, we're seeing that influx as well in terms of conversations around diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? Specifically with cannabis, we know, you know, during the pandemic, a host of states decided to regulate, right? Now, we can go back and forth in terms of why, but we know that more and more the tax revenue that is generated from cannabis, you know, it became more and more appealing to these states as they were dealing with the pandemic and their coffers were being empty, right? So it's like, okay, hey, there's a new source of funding here. And so then you have this influx of interest around equity and social equity operators and legacy. And so our position with at the ecosystem is that, you know, the growth and sustainability of the cannabis industry depends on the transitioning, right? And I'm gonna say the respectful transitioning of legacy operators into the regulated space. Now, what you just said, like, just rings true for me in terms of all of this interest, and there have been people here doing it, but you have these conditions created where they are not being acknowledged, you know, and energy is not being put on essentially transitioning these businesses that are already standing. They already have loyal customers. You know, they already have respect in their community. So why is the energy not being put to these existing operators?
Yeah, so, you know, man, my why to that, I think goes back to, man, back to the beginning of the what you first said when we introduced the conversation of like this war on drugs and just the like narrative that that painted for our communities. within low-income communities specifically, we had both a war on poverty coming in the mid-60s, and then later this war on drugs coming in the early 70s. And what they both simultaneously painted a picture of mistrust and incompetency, essentially, of low-income communities. First, the war on poverty was like well-intentioned. Lyndon B. Johnson actually came out with a really progressive statement at the time and said something along the lines of like, 20% poverty rate here in America is a moral failing of us, of a nation, not a moral failing of our communities. And said the fact that we're not allowing families and communities to develop to their strengths and their talents in the way that they could is on us. We got to look at that. Yeah. Then later on, Reagan comes along, right? We all hear the story about the welfare queen. We all hear the story about this picture painted of what low-income mothers, what they're doing, clearly drenched in racism, as we're talking about the welfare queen and her attributes, clearly drenched in racism. And so we had this mixture of we're fighting poverty because it's bad, and that, but yet it was never like, here's how we're going to do it by like empowering the strengths of communities. It was like, we have to take care of are these people in these communities, if that makes sense. And then you added this, like, also don't trust people in these communities. And those two narratives of like incompetent, like basically unable to care for themselves.
The infantilizing of adults, right?
This is it. That's stuck. That is still really salient in a lot of the programming that I've been a part of myself, right? I'm still growing and learning as I go, but this idea that we have to like help people and teach people be better at parenting and better at living and better at making money and all these things, and that we have to kind of check up on people and make them prove themselves all the time. This idea of kind of policing our families, even as part of social services programs, super salient. And I believe informs why when we start to think about how important early childhood is and funding coming in programs, why we're not thinking, let's put money in the people. Instead, we're thinking, how do we build programs to fix the people, right?
Yeah. It's this idea that you know, what exists can't be right because we didn't have a hand in it, right? It's that savior thing of like, let me help you be better. Let me teach you because, you know, what you're doing clearly, you know, this clearly could not be the answer.
I mean, and I played a part in this too. Like I'm gonna tell you more about the exact conversation when the light switch went off in my head related to this connection between cannabis and early childhood. But there's this sense within the early childhood field and community that in-home care is it's just not quite the same as center-based care. It's like lesser, right? There's this lower quality there. It's like in-home. And I have held that sentiment. I don't know that I've ever said that word out loud, like in-home isn't, but I know that I've held that sentiment myself. Yeah. And my solution to that still, like knowing that it was like, it's not quite there, but we can get there. Like, so being even a little bit, maybe let's say further along in my conceptualization of it, of thinking of like, we can get there. Whereas a lot of the field is like not even interested in going into in-home. We're like interested in pulling all these kids into our big programs and our big institutions. So me thinking like, oh, we can get there. I'm like, and I'm a little bit further along in my thought process and realizing that like my thoughts about how we get there is, hey, come work for us. Mm-hmm. Right. So I had these thoughts of like, okay, we're going to take all these women who are doing childcare. We're going to come train them and we're going to come hire them at our centers. We build these centers. We're going to hire these people.
Right.
And that was my thought here. And like, we know that the sustainability of early childhood and childcare is not there. Right. We know that it costs more to do it than though anybody can really afford to do. Right. Yes. And so we also know that everybody who is in the field across the board is not being paid adequately.
This is not a get rich scheme. Right. Like going into early childhood is not like, oh, going into education, period, is not like I'm doing this because I want to become a millionaire or a billionaire.
No.
Like, these are labors of love, right?
And what I need everybody to consider is like when we talk about going into education and we have all this national dialogue about teachers, I'm here for it. Teachers need to be treated way better. The public education system needs to be looked at. Early childhood is even more disadvantaged in terms of how those teachers are being paid, treated, what the circumstances are they're facing.
Absolutely.
So I'm still in this space, right? I'm like, okay, we're going to bring them into these programs. We're going to hire them. They're going to work for us. But that's not a beneficial, lucrative career for people. So it actually took conversations with you and a conversation with this really, really smart childcare provider in Memphis. And this light bulb went off in my head of like, why are we not taking a cue from the cannabis industry, specifically the people's ecosystem, in putting our money and resources and efforts behind the people who have been doing this and creating sustainable programs in communities where families are already wanting to be, where they're already trusted, and even more so making sure that all this money that's finally coming to support early childhood, for those of us who have been like rallying behind public funding for early childhood for a decade or more, it's finally coming. Why are we not making sure that it lands in the communities it's meant to support versus, to your point, building up more nonprofits and more programs and contributing to this billion-dollar industry, but never making it back into the community ecosystem to strengthen that system as we're investing in those programs?
Yeah. You know, it's something that, you know, we're pushing in terms of what we call credible community voices, right? Because there's always this mindset of like, we're going to come in and maybe there are conversations with a few folks. And when I'm saying this, I'm saying all industries, right? So in terms of early childhood, in terms of, you know, cannabis, it's like, we're going to come in, we're going to talk to a couple of folks, right? And that's where it kind of stops, right? Like there's not this intentionality of like, how are you finding, and this is something that we did in organizing as well. It's like, you got to find your true leaders, right? Like you have to find the people who really have a pulse of the area, who really know what's going on. And the reality is that those people may not be the most polished, right? Like those people may not use language that, that speaks to your soul. Like they may not have, you know, those key phrases, those key buzzwords, but what they do have is the pulse. What they do have is the trust and the respect of the community. And many of them have outcycled, you know, other initiatives that may be similar to this, right? Like, so they know how things go, right? Like, they understand what happens, and they've chosen to stay in their area, in their home, in that community. And so oftentimes what we see, and I'll speak to cannabis and then I'll let you jump in, is that, you know, there will be talk, there's talk of, well, you wanna, you know, you wanna buy from a dispensary because it's been tested, you know, and you can trust this, and you can actually go into this physical location. And it's like, well, boo, I trust my provider. Like,
I trust my guy. Yeah.
I've been buying from the same person for, you know, 20, 30 years or whatever have you. I know this quality. They know what I like. They know what I want. Like, you know, they're not going to BS me. And in terms of, you know, some of these outlier cases where, you know, people may have gotten a batch that was laced with something, and, you know, heart goes out to anyone who's experienced that. But for the most part, like, cannabis has been here. Like, this has been here. It's been here. This plant has been here through generations. If you look at historical texts, you will see mentions of burning bushes and this being used in all kind of healing practices, right? And so people have been using this and have been all right. You know what I mean? Like, it's not to say that there have not been some cases, but it's like, Now we got a question, like, where are those cases occurring? Like, how is this happening? What's happening? Because there are a number of people who have very solid relationships with their legacy operators. They know what they're getting. They know the quality, and it has been a part of their wellness, you know, their wellness plan, their wellness routine for a lifetime. So the same thing, I think, applies to these early childhood educators. It's like, okay, yeah, maybe granny, you know, maybe the granny or big mama, you know, they don't use all of the language in terms of, like, preparing their lesson plans and things of that nature. But guess what? When it was time for my baby to go to pre-K, my baby knew their colors. They knew how to count. They knew their alphabet. You know, and it may have been because grandma was sewing something and said, give me the red yarn, or give me this, or give me that. My baby knows what they need to know.
Yeah, you're speaking to... Man, there's two words that stuck up as you were talking to me. So the first is, like, expertise. Like, what is expertise? What does that really mean? And the second being trust, right? Like, what is trust and what does that really mean? And, like, my thing there is, it doesn't have to be either or. So when we talk about education, there is things to know. There is science and there is research and there is best practice. And that's real. Like, in the same way that, like, I don't pretend to say that I can teach, like, eighth grade biology unless I do some learning on the best strategies and the content. That's real as well for early childhood providers. But you can do that. You can take all the strengths that you just outlined, all of the natural learning experiences that just happen within communities and within families, like, your, to your point about, like, the red yarn, you can take that and you can lean into the trust and expertise that she has, that auntie down the road has, and invest in her and build her so that she's both a kind of evidence-based practice provider, because we do know that specific interventions work differently in terms of development and brain outcomes, and comes with a clear knowledge of what the community needs and what the community values, and comes with ingrained trust. And so that's that one thing. It's like, it doesn't have to be one or the other. It just means that we need to, like I said before, we need to challenge this narrative about, like, competency and trust, and recognize that that's a thing that we're telling ourselves or we've been told about communities. And then the other piece is, what does trust mean? So when we're in social services programs across the board, and whoever we're serving, every time we have a conversation, there's a conversation about trust, building trust with the community. We need to build trust. And it's coming from a perspective of, like, convincing families to trust people who look like me in these programs. Trust me, you gotta trust me, we're convincing. It's never coming from a place of, like, how can I, MJ, become more trustworthy? Like, what do I need to do to be a trustworthy partner in the life of family?
Right.
Because I can tell you all the reasons why families are scared or fearful or don't trust using programs. And we've already talked about a lot of them, racism being one of them, condescending and like shame and being treated poorly. The war on drugs heightened their amount of sensitivity around, are you using something? Do we need to call CPS? What's CPS going to say about this? There's all these reasons why communities don't necessarily engage with public service and programs in the way that like sometimes we wish they would. And we talk about building trust, but you know who they do engage with? The women down the street who they've been engaging with for the last 30 years. Like they trust her and they should. She's not doing any of those things that I just named. There's an opportunity for both.
I think intentions versus outcomes, right? Because in most cases, you know, let's just give people the benefit of the doubt in saying that their intentions are good, right? The intention is to use these funds, to input these funds into systems where you think that the outcome that you want is going to come from. But that is not always the case, right? The intentions don't always match the outcomes. And I think a lot of that is to do with how well are we using what we already have, you know, and how are we also intentionally, being respectful and acknowledging where people are, the skill set that they have, as opposed to coming in with the energy of like dictating, right? And the energy of fixing, right? So one thing you mentioned that really stuck out to me was like the stigma, right? Like the stigma of early childhood, how a lot of that also matches the stigma of cannabis, right? And cannabis prohibition. I mean, we all grew up in DARE, right? Like this is your brain on drugs, just say no. But the things that like we weigh with importance and how we look at things, how we view the professionalism of all things, right? Mm-hmm. And the work that's being done. And so, you know, you have cannabis being regulated in a number of states. I think we're at like 37 now for medical, 18 for adult use. But you literally still have people who look like me, you know, and just women in general, though, who are losing their kids, right? Or who are having to continue to fight this battle in terms of how they parent and in terms of their parenting being, I guess, kind of pitted against their wellness.
Yeah, there's this... to your point about the stigma, there's two directions you went there, and there's both concerns here. The idea that, like you mentioned, what is valuable and what's important, and what's kind of like high moral, high honorable, you know, honorable work and honorable industry, and the fact that early childhood and childcare hasn't been considered important work or hard work or necessary. So we still see childcare workers listed as unskilled work in a lot of places, or listed as unskilled labor. And the reality is that, I mean, I don't know. Have you ever been alone in a room with 12 2-year-olds? Like, can you tell me that's unskilled? Like, no. One is enough, let alone 12 to two, whatever. So there's that, but it's just not been considered valuable, right? So we're not putting the money and the resource and the respect in. So that's the one piece about like the stigma piece. It's just not as much of a stigma on it, but just not as much of a respect placed on it. But to your other point about stigma related to families and usage, one of the things that I see come up a lot is during my programming time was cannabis being used to treat a range of concerns with mothers, specifically women, and the danger in that for those same women. And yet other options are not available. So a really, really common example is trauma and PTSD symptoms. We know that sexual assault and physical assault is 1 in 3 when it comes to women. It gets even more when it comes to Black women, even more when it comes to Black women in low-income communities. So we're talking about a lot of women walking around managing some really serious experiences and symptoms related to that without access to the support they need to be able to manage these things, which should be a range of services. A lot of the moms I served didn't have any health insurance at all, weren't eligible for any type of Medicaid or health insurance in order to get either medication that could support some anxiety symptoms, some therapy, just a break so they could breathe once in a while to mental manage their own stuff. So yeah, we'll see cannabis as an option for that, right? We know it treats anxiety. We know it works with PTSD symptoms and dissociation. We know it just generally takes off the edge a little bit so people can make it through what they need to get through. And the community has known forever that the side effects are that are limited or none. It's not having the same impact on bodies that a lot of self-regulating or self-medicating strategies do, right? It's a good solution for families who need it, especially if we don't have other options for support. Here's the thing, though. Back to this idea of like not trusting in the morality of families and already deciding that low-income mothers are less of mothers. You can see where this is going when moms are using cannabis to regulate their symptoms. The first time that becomes public knowledge, and now we're talking about custody concerns, CPS concerns, parenting, being terminated, legal concerns. And I'm here to tell you that the first time that a young mother gets involved with that system, with the legal system related to drugs of any kind, but also related to CPS and any type of concerns around parenting or what some would call neglect, getting out of that, getting through that, that being resolved and families getting ahead is at best years of a journey, at worst doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
Really serious implications.
And I think that's an important piece because we also see specifically, through cannabis prohibition, we see and we are experiencing the creation of these second tier, lesser tier of people, right? Like, so to your point about like once a family has that mark, it's similar to, you know, having a felony on your record. Like once you have that mark, you are even more scrutinized, right? You're already scrutinized because you come from a marginalized community. You know, you come from an impacted community. But once you have that mark, right, like once that's on your record, even more so. And so I guess the question is, you know, there's legislation and all of it, you know, handles this to varying degrees in terms of expungement, right? Like in terms of like the cleaning and clearing of these records so that people can, you know, regain access, right? And be like their full selves and live their full lives, right? And have this autonomy of their selves and their conditions. What are you seeing in your space in terms of like, you know, are there opportunities of kind of like shaking this off and like ridding yourself of this like scarlet letter once you have it on you?
You know what to your point about the implications of being othered or being kind of brought, there's this label attached. What we see with moms even more so is that it starts to build. So let's talk about domestic violence, obviously a huge concern. What I've seen is moms walk out of domestic violence situations with assault charges. Despite more often than not being the aggressor, walking out with assault charges. So we have a criminal record here. Then what we're seeing is often moms who don't have access to any type of help or support using cannabis to treat PTSD symptoms that came from this domestic violence that brought to the assault charge. So now we might have a drug charge on top of that. Once the drug charge comes in, and it could just be usage or possession, right? Just something small. But once that comes in, CPS is now going to be a part of this conversation. And so now you might have open CPS cases. What those can turn into is abuse or neglect charges related. And so now you have an assault charge, maybe a drug charge. You also maybe have a child abuse or a child neglect charge. So you can imagine you pull someone's record and those three things are sitting there and the implications of that on any amount of professional growth, school, there's a whole world of careers you can never enter. I'm not, I'm not seeing a ton of weight, like change in terms of that being a reality of those things being stacked. What I will say is that the industry, well, family services, and depending upon kind of what train of, or I guess, area of thought we subscribe to within the work, what we are seeing is entrepreneurial investment programs, trust-based cash investments in families, and a push to really like redistribute the power of women specifically. So for those women who have this kind of long list of things they have to overcome in order to find employment, what we're seeing is programs that are either just giving cash to invest, knowing that she will do what she needs to do in a creative way.
She always does, right?
So she always does. And that I don't know what she needs. Like, so me trying to create a program and go here and do this and you get this, this, and this, like, first of all, it's not going to work for more than two women because they all have different unique circumstances. But second of all, like, I don't know. So how am I creating a program? Like, I'm not her. I don't have these. I don't have her life. I don't have her babies. I don't have, right? Like, she's the only one that knows that. So we are seeing a push. I'd like to see it strong. But we are seeing a push in honoring that, recognizing that, putting resources behind her and letting her decide and lead the way. And we are seeing a push for getting women into entrepreneurial fields, supporting women in more traditionally male-dominated fields, like the trades work, because those background concerns up there.
Yeah.
And they're more lucrative. They're paid more money when they enter those industries. So we're seeing that. I would like to see it move faster, but we're seeing some change.
Yeah. You know, what you said about the stacking was interesting to me. This is another area of like where there's correlation, right? So, you know, you mentioned whether it's use, whether it's for consumption or whether it's for sale in terms of a mother or a family having involvement with drugs in general, right? The interesting thing is, you know, all sentencing that is related to substances that seem to be more prevalent in marginalized communities have use and sale viewed similarly, right? So like, you know what I mean? So like, you know, like with crack, those sentences were higher than cocaine, whether it was for personal use or sale. You see the same with cannabis, right? Like with weed, right? Reefer, these are other names for it, right? But the same thing, that regardless if it was for like consumption, personal consumption use, and or sale, those, the sentencing, right? And the consequences that were attached to them were totally different than what we're seeing with opioids that, you know, were allowed to become an epidemic, you know.
A health crisis. Yeah.
Health crisis, and where treatment was pushed, right? Like, we got to get these people treated. We have to have, and I think it's almost, I'm just going to be real. It's a slap in the face to even see in language where revenue generated from cannabis sales is being used for treatment programs to get people off of opioids, right? To get folks off of opioids, when none of that was lended to I'm going to say the crack epidemic, right? Like, none of that was lended to that, which specifically impacted communities of color, right? So I'm going to say it's a slap in the face. So that's one thing, right? That just stuck out to me. It was like that stacking and how use and sale are viewed in the same way or are treated, you know, similarly.
You're making me think. So that makes me think, go back to what I originally had brought up about this idea of the war on drugs and where that narrative went, and how at that time we were paying, even at the time when we talked about crack and we talked about the impact on communities, the way that we talked about it was that the poverty and the hardships of poverty and the kind of disconnect that was happening in our communities were because of drug use or because of kind of sometimes there's mental health concerns there or because of like some sort of moral failings when we really know in reality, like the opposite of those things are happening, right? Like the use of drugs in the community, specifically at that time, was a symptom of the hardships and the just unfathomable conditions that our neighborhoods and communities were living in, having to experience And like painted it the opposite.
People living in war zones and just trying to, like, to make it through.
And painting it the opposite. Painting it as, like, people are, this is, the conditions are like this because people are creating war zones rather than people are living in war zones and this is the impact on them.
Absolutely.
So that's interesting to me. And so then when you were talking about use and treatment and how we've started talking about opioids as a treatment piece, I've been thinking about, we're not having cannabis treatment conversations for obvious reasons, but yet we still haven't really named the fact that we don't need cannabis treatment programs, right? So why are we criminalizing it the way we have when it's not? So that's a thing. But what was always really unclear to me was whenever we would have, like, let's say we'd have a mom, I was supporting a parent who was open with like a CPS case, for example. And mom knows that if she fails a UA, it could mean removal or it could mean delayed reunification. She knows that. And what I know about moms across the world is that with whatever hardships and skill sets we have, we all show up at different ways. We all do show up in literally the best way that we can. I know that that's true. And again, some people have been through some stuff. So it doesn't mean we always show up in an adequate way. Sometimes we fall short, but we all show up the best way that we can.
Exactly.
So if mom knows that if I fail a UA, my baby's going to be taken from me, and yet she still is using cannabis, what does that tell us?
That she needs it.
She is clearly dealing with something. And she clearly is just trying to get through.
Yeah.
Because why else would she take that risk? It always blew my mind that the response was like, and I would say, like, this is like, self, she, you know, there's PTSD symptoms here. She's self-medicating. And the response is like, well, that's not the right way to do it. Then we need to, like, figure out, get some help. I'm like, I agree. But, like, what's the right way to do it? Like, there's a right way to have PTSD? Like,
and I was about to say, like, you know, when people say, well, that's the wrong way to handle it. I mean, okay, so maybe you go home and you have a couple of drinks. Is that the right way to handle it? Because,
you know. Is your baby going to be taken because you failed a UA for a couple glasses of wine yesterday? Like, that was always a big thing for me. Like, if we see that women are still using, despite knowing full well the risks at hand, whether it should be that way or not, right? It is that way. We know that there's a risk.
Right.
Why are we not asking ourselves, man, what is it that she is facing to take that risk?
Why?
Yeah. And it goes, again, full circle back to this narrative of what we tell ourselves about low-income women. And the why, I think, deep-seated why is that we believe that mom doesn't care. We believe that mom's putting herself and or something above her children. I don't know. I don't know what the why is, but it's clearly not an accurate assessment of what every mom around the world wants for their babies. You know, clearly not. Clearly not accurate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. MJ. This time has sped by. So we definitely have to chop it up some more, but I appreciate you for coming and spending time with the people on the People Are Blunt to make this connection, right? Because again, we talk about, you know, from the entrepreneurial standpoint of getting into cannabis, whether it's ancillary businesses or plant touching. But I really wanted to dive into, you know, the correlations and the sameness that exists in these communities in terms of, you know, what those who are essentially kind of left behind to pick up the pieces and figure things out, what they're going through. And so parting words from you, first of all, you know, what would you want to leave to the people, with the people, in terms of these two, you know, these two kind of playing fields. And then also, how can people, like, find you, get in touch with you if they're interested in the work that you're doing, you know, and how to uplift and learn more about that?
Yeah, definitely. Parting words. I am so aware of how y'all are pioneers. I mean, the act of getting ahead of an industry that's coming, that's booming, and doing so in a way that that examines equity in all aspects of it and plans to set up the circumstances needed to make sure that as the industry grows, we can do our best to make it an equitable way and to include the voices of the people who have been impacted by inequity and marginalization for history, but also who have been really the founders of this industry. And that is a lesson. That's the learning lesson that I wish for early childhood to see and to enact within our own space of how are we getting ahead of what's coming, of the money and the funding and the interest and the legislation, and how we're making sure that we're advocating on behalf of the community and what's best. So that's my parting word. So my call to the people, but my call to my field, to the early childhood folks who maybe are listening to this too and can start to see this connection of the power of getting ahead of it, acting on behalf of the people early on in the game so that as it continues to boom, we are in a space to do so well. And then as far as like learning more and getting to know more about me, I think just checking out my LinkedIn profile, and there's a whole bunch of resources there in terms of videos and articles and stuff to read about the impact of early childhood. And I think that's it too, just starting to learn more about what the first 5 years of life do and how they really set the tone for equity / inequity for the length of someone's life. It happens before birth, happens early on. And if we can do something about it that early, has really profound impact on the lives of kids and communities.
I don't have anything to say. I think you just mic dropped it. I think it is what it is. Absolutely. We have to make sure that we are broadening the scope of what the word expert means, what the word skilled means, and taking into account people who have figured out ways to operate and to fill needs and to fill voids with less than, you know, and still making it happen. We have to make sure that we are honoring, that we are acknowledging, and that we are transitioning in the best way.
Isn't it?
People who matter, you know, and the people who are already doing it. With that, I would say, you see on the ticker, we got MJ's Insta and LinkedIn information, MJ Corpella, you know, holla at her, find her,
Absolutely.
And support the work that she's doing. And so the next time,
thank you so much.